Blog Talk Radio.
Hope you're doing well today. Those of you in the United States, especially on the West Coast, must be aware of Hurricane Patricia. This morning it came down into the Puerto Vallarta area, which I'm familiar with, and strangely, even though it was a Category 5 hurricane and believed to be the strongest ever recorded in the Western Hemisphere, it didn't really do much damage. Tremendous amount of rain. It was a direct hit on the mainland. But other than a few rooftops being lifted up, there were no casualties. Just a tremendous amount of rain. And that is amazing, because if that same hurricane had hit on the East Coast, that would have caused some serious damage, even if it had come up through Texas, which or Louisiana, which a number of these hurricanes end up traveling, it would have caused a lot of damage. So I have a lot of friends in Mexico, and so I'm calling out to you guys to hang it tough. And so far, so good. So I hope it passes quickly. Also, as a reminder, this is the end of the Sitchin Week. Remember, the Zachariah Sitchin program is to announce the arrival of the Anunnaki Chronicles, a Zechariah Sitchin reader, which is now available on Amazon and a lot of other websites. But if you go to Inner Traditions website, which I will post a link of to Earth Ancients Facebook page group and international pages, if you go to that link, instead of paying full price, publisher will give you a 40% discount. A 40% discount. And the way you get the discount, this is good for all of the books, not only the Anunnaki Chronicle, but all the books, the Earth Chronicle series and everything else. All you need to do is type in the word aliens under code, A-L-I-E-N-S, and you'll automatically be extended a full 40%. Now that's a pretty big discount. So check it out. It's only going to be good in for a few more days. It's been happening this whole week. We had Janet Sitchin on last week, as you remember. So great opportunity, great discount. And all you got to do, again, aliens is the code for a huge discount on all the books, all the Earth Chronicle series, and anything Sitchin is available, even some of the audio tapes. So check that out. I want to note something that came up a couple of weeks ago that I didn't bring up. There was an article written in a online magazine called AncientCodes.com, and the author highlighted a 2008 paper that was presented at the International Conference of Geoarchaeology and Archaeomineralogy. It was in Sofia, Italy. And two Ukrainian geologists presented a paper called Geological Aspects of the Problem of Dating the Great Egyptian Sphinx Construction. And what they did, and the reason I'm talking about this is the number they came up with will blow your mind. If you remember, 20 years ago, Robert Schoch, John Anthony West reported that the Sphinx was probably 5,000 years older than was previously thought. Most Egyptologists think it's 2,500 years old, or the time of Khufu. But the other sciences, the true sciences, got involved in the dating, and geological science, specifically the work of Robert Schoch, Dr. Robert Schoch from Boston University, dated the Sphinx based on the water weathering, not the wind, but the water weathering to 12,500 or older in about 20 years ago. Now, he's increased that number by a few thousand years, but these two Ukrainian geologists used some of the similar techniques that Schoch did, but also included some computer modeling, and basically came up with a number of 800,000 years old for the Sphinx. And I'm laughing because it's almost mind-boggling to consider that the Sphinx would be that old. 800,000 years old. Now, that is so old that we have to start thinking about the mystical yugas, the Hindu yugas, who describe mankind in millions of years, and they have the cycles, the various cycles, the yuga cycles. And 800,000 years ago would be, well, that's almost a million years ago. That would have been a period of time. And I don't have my Yuga calendar in front of me, but obviously it must have been a very highly civilized period. And the only thing that comes to mind as I think about that is, of course, Mars. And a number of authors have written about Mars, and what they're thinking is there's an Egyptian pre-dynastic connection, and the Great Sphinx is considered pre-dynastic. Most likely a civilization that came around before the Egyptians, who built the Sphinx, and then through erosion the Egyptians built on top of it and put that Egyptian head on it. But anyhow, isn't that mind-blowing? 800,000 years. Now, I'm going to post this article on Facebook. Again, it's geological aspects of the problem of dating the Egyptian Sphinx. And the funny thing about it, this author, this writer, just found it in this report, in this geological study. And I did a quick check, and it turns out that Robert Schoch, Dr. Robert Schoch, references this paper in his most recent book. Now, why this has been kept quiet is baffling. I think probably the biggest reason is that 800,000 years old is becomes ridiculous. But this is these are scientists, and they're just casually putting that number together, that the weathering, that the surface of that area is extremely, extremely old. So, now remember, the Sphinx isn't built like a typical pyramid with rocks, excuse me, with cut precision granite. It was carved from a single solid stone. It was probably a small mountain that it was carved, a limestone rock, and it was excavated, and the Sphinx enclosure, which surrounds the Sphinx, was also carved out. So these two scientists are saying, well, this is what we see in our basis of understanding, in our computer modeling, is that it's 800,000 years old. So think about that one. And I'll post it on the Facebook page to check it out. So, okay, now we are going to present our talk today. The author is Mark Pinkham, and the subject is Sedona, City of the Star People. So here is that interview. So we've had a number of people talking about native traditions. We just recently had Clifford Mahody on, who is a Zuni elder and wisdom keeper, and he has talked about the tradition of the Star People and their connections with the native people of not only the Zuni tribes, but a lot of other native cultures around the United States. The talk, if you remember, was very interesting because our interest was the trek from Lemuria into central, which is now Mexico. And then he talked about the trails of migrations from Central America up into Arizona, New Mexico, into California and other parts of the U.S. and the traditions of the Kachina and the Star People that was about. We also had Artie Six Killer Clark, who wrote a book called Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians. And we had her on twice, and she basically recorded and interviewed thousands of natives from Central America and North America. And not only do the Maya to this day have a belief and have a connection with Star People, in her book, she actually witnesses one of these ships. And if you want to hear about that, you can find Artie Six Killer Clark's recording on the Blog Talk Radio Earth Ancients website. You can go find it there. You can download it. But today, our guest has done a tremendous amount of research, not only into Native Hopi culture and their wisdom teachings, but has found what appears to be archaeology from a ET civilization in the Sedona area. My guest today is Mark Pinkham. Mark has written a book called Sedona, City of the Star People, and we're going to hear today about his research into what looks like a fantastic revelation of indigenous culture, but also Mark being actually living in that area has found some amazing artifacts. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Cliff. Thanks for having me on.
So tell me, what was the initial motivation to write a book like this? Had you been out walking around and stumbled on these ruins, or was it more that you just had an interest from past research?
Well, it was a 27-year process, Cliff. I first arrived in Sedona back in 1987, and one of the first places I went to here was one of the largest vortexes. There's four major vortexes. The largest of them all is Boynton Canyon. So I was guided in there and walked a distance deep into the canyon. And I sat down to meditate. I was up high on a ridge, closed my eyes, and a voice inside says, "Open your eyes." I did. And the next thing I knew, everywhere I looked, I saw temples. The whole canyon was covered with these temples. And of course, I didn't notice them on the way in, but there they were. I thought they were all physical. I thought they looked as though they were carved out of the red rock, and they were perfect. I even saw statues amongst the temples. It was like there's a civilization there. And like I said, I thought these were solid temples until I went down and got close to them. And as soon as I got close to them, it's like they disappeared. And I kept trying for, virtually the next 12 to 14 hours. I spent the night in the canyon. But it just kept happening. And so I finally decided, well, I guess I'm not supposed to get close to these temples. I'm certainly not supposed to enter them this time. But I vowed at that time I was going to spend the next, however long it took me in my life, to get an answer about what these temples are about. Who built them? Why are they there? What are they there for? And so I have I followed through on that commitment, and I've gone back there, I mean, virtually hundreds of times. And when I finally got to a point where I did understand what they were all about, then I waited a little bit longer, and then I felt the inner guidance to write about them. So that the result is my book.
That's interesting. Now you mentioned in your book that Sedona sits on the foundations of this ancient city built by ETs called the Palawalpi. Now when you say that, is that handed down to you by the Hopi elders that the whole city of Sedona was once this ET city, or is it just insight in your excavation or research of this ancient city?
Well, I have to say it's mostly my own personal research. During that 27-year period, I came across information about this city of the Star People, a city that was built and occupied by the Star People, which the Hopi is known as the Kachinas. And in their legends, it talks about them arriving in the North American continent and then being separated into clans by their patron deity that met them in North America, named Masao. And then he told them to go on migrations all around the Western Hemisphere. And when they finished their migrations, they came to where they are today, on Hopi land. Well, when they finished their migrations, they kind of got together and they compared notes. Well, where you been? Well, I've been over here. Where you been? And it turns out most all of the clans at one time or another had been in this sacred holy city called Palawalpi. Palawalpi means the red house, the red place, the red house. And so the clans talked to each other about how the Kachinas, the Star People, had built Palawalpi, and what they learned there. They talked about the great towering temples that were once there. And so I kept studying more and more about Palawalpi. Fascinating, fascinating. And then when I get to the point of trying to figure out the location of Palawalpi, all the evidence pointed here. What I did is that I studied where these tribes went after they left Palawalpi on their way to get to where they are now in Hopi Land. And along that route, they stopped at certain places, and they talk, and they then they mentioned the place names of those places, and those places are still here. I mean, they are in Arizona. And so what I did is I started in Hopi Land, and then I retraced their steps, and in each case, it ended up here, back here in Sedona and the Verde Valley. Well, as it turns out, I'm not the only one that had concluded that Sedona was Palawalpi. Jesse Fuchs, for example, one of the great archaeologists and ethnologists of his day, he spent a lot of time amongst the Hopis, and he was so sure that this was Palawalpi, that Sedona was, that he named one site here that's virtually covered with pictographs and petroglyphs of the Hopis. He named it Palatki, which is a version of Palawalpi, because he was sure that this was Palawalpi. Well, besides him, there was a number of other people that also decided this area was Palawalpi because they named a trail that leads from here to Hopi Reservation. They named it the Palawalpi Trail. And that trail has been used for hundreds and hundreds of years by traders, by the Native Americans themselves, to move between Hopi Land and Sedona and the Verde Valley. So I wasn't the first to come across that revelation, but in modern times, I seem to be the first to kind of put two and two together and designate Sedona as Palawalpi.
Interesting. Now, what do we know about the Palawalpi? Were they humanoid beings? Were they what did they What did they look like? Do we have any idea of where they came from and how they settled this part of the country?
Well, apparently, Cliff, they weren't that different in their features weren't that different than modern humans. When the Hopis arrived in North America and they were asked to go on their migrations, it was at that time that they met these star people, and the star people actually accompanied them on their migrations, and then they led them to all parts of the Western Hemisphere and then to their city of Polokwane. And it talks in the legends of the Hopis that a lot of these star people were living in physical bodies or nearly physical, like you and I, and they had families and they had children, and some of them were even farmers. But of course, the greatest of them all were definitely the teachers and taught the mysteries of the universe and the mysteries of human evolution. And these were really the teachers that were, these were really the star people in Polokwane. These were the ones that taught really the highest mysteries. And Masao was one of these high teachers. And he also had what I call a second in command, a star being known as Aholi. And Aholi taught the mysteries of the plumed serpent. The mysteries of the plumed serpent is mysteries of awakening the evolutionary force, which we in the West have come to know as the Kundalini, and then guiding that force throughout the body, up the spine, opening the chakras, opening the centers of Gnostic awareness, leading it to the top of the head, and opening the crown chakra, which the Hopis and the star people knew as Kopavi. They called it Kopavi, and it was necessary as part of the mysteries of the plumed serpent that this Kopavi become open, because it's shut down that humans are not in alignment with a higher will. The belief is that we're in the fourth world now, and the first world, they judge time in terms of worlds. During the first world, humanity had the Kopavi wide open, and so this is why they could live in alignment with the higher will. Over these four worlds, it's gradually slowed down, closed to where it is today. So part of the mysteries of the plumed serpent was to open that Kopavi. So you could say that the first world corresponded to what we think of Lemuria times, when human beings were lived intuitively, and they had a complete intuitive connection with all people, all things. Everything was one. There was no separation. It was like the first part of the Garden of Eden story. But later on, after eating the forbidden fruit, the first couple, they developed the intellect and the ego, and separation then started to set in, and that corresponds to what we call the second world. And the third world really corresponds to what we call Atlantis, and now we are in the fourth world now.
So what do the Hopi how did they interact with these ETs? Were they accepted readily as teachers, or was it more of kind of a forced situation where these ETs came down and said, "Look, you need to get your act together," or what? What is your understanding for the interaction with these ETs?
My understanding is that they accepted them as teachers and protectors, and what you find all around the world in the creation myths of so many different tribes is that when these tribes were first organized, that there were beings that showed up. And often in their creation myths, they call them the twins, the twin boys. And also the Hopis have their twins, but the twin boys were two or seven or 144. But the twin boys is simply another name for what they call the sons of God in the Bible, right? And the sons of God were the ETs that came down and intermarried with the earth women. But what they brought were the sacred and the sacred mundane mysteries, you know, the sacred scientists, the mundane scientists of agriculture and medicine, or the sacred sciences of the mysteries of the plumed serpent. And so the Hopis consider these to be great masters of the universe. I mean, they consider them to be gods, right, virtually. And they consider them to be extremely highly evolved. And eventually the tradition evolved that the Hopis themselves, if they worked enough on themselves and evolved enough themselves, that they themselves would transform into a Kachina, either in this lifetime or when they leave this body, they become a Kachina. So they held these Kachinas as the pinnacle of evolution, that they had achieved the highest point of evolution.
So if I get you right, these off-world beings showed the Hopi techniques of sacred sciences, which I kind of translate to be things like working with geomagnetic fields, working with the ley lines of the earth to connect with higher consciousness and chakras, and intuition. So what would be, what would, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, basing some of that on the book, but I didn't read the entire book. What else would we consider?
Well, they considered that the Kachinas had been, they created the whole entire universe. There were some Kachinas, some of the greatest Kachinas. Sotan Khan was one, and he was this ET that flew around in a extraterrestrial craft wearing one of these seamless silver suits that you associate with kind of these, you know, these 50s, you know, science fiction movies, right? But he was one of the creators of the whole entire universe, right? So these were the masters of the universe. They weren't just some low level teachers. These were masters. These were people that, these were gods that created the universe and then came here especially to assist humankind on its path of growth and evolution. They knew all the mysteries, everything. You know, these because they invented them. They invented all the mysteries. They knew them all.
Wow. That's fascinating. You know, in your book, you talk a lot about Boynton Canyon. And I'm curious, can you describe what you found there? Because that's, I think, in the book, it's pretty much the Red Rock Canyon that has the most emphasis on dwellings and sculptures and things like that. That actually come to light during your meditation, but you know, in our wakingness, it actually has evidence of true ruins. Correct?
Oh, absolutely. The first time I was in there back in '87, when I had climbed the side of the canyon, and I was sitting on a ledge and doing a little prayer, and then the voice inside of me says, "Hey, look inside. Look in front of you, rather." So I opened my eyes, and in front of me, right across the canyon, were these two gigantic pillars. And it looked like somebody had just been there with a hammer and chisel. And so it looked definitely as though there was some human influence in the creation of these. And it was at that point that I started looking around, and then I started seeing all these temples. I also looked to the side of the canyon, and there was like this huge symbol there. It was a symbol of looked like a big Native American head, and on top of that was another smaller head. And then my intuition informed me, this voice inside informed me, saying, well, that's a symbol of a colony, right? The small head was colonizing the land of the big head. And the small head represent Lemuria, the Lemurians, or the people of Mu. And And so what that symbol represented is that I was in a colony of the Lemurians, a colony of Mu, that they were the ones that had created these temples. So, and so it was apparently either the Kachinas who were the Lemurians that came there and made the temples, or other Lemurians came and they assisted the Kachinas in making those temples, one or both. So then, as I mentioned, I got down off the ledge I was on, and then I went ahead and tried to get to these temples. And as soon as I got near one, they just kind of like disappeared. Well, I came back again to Boynton some time later, and I had a similar experience where I saw those temples, and this time when I got near them, they didn't completely disappear. It's like half of them disappeared, and what was left was that temple, that perfect temple, in a ruined condition, right? So that's what you see there. You see the temples in a ruined condition. So people are seeing them all the time, but they're saying, well, these are just red rocks that kind of look like temples because they're not perfect, right?
Okay.
But they just keep walking on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw these temples in the ruined condition, then I started researching the flood history of Sedona, because it looked like the what had ruined these temples was water. It was waterware that they were suffering from.
So water erosion, you mean? Water erosion from...
Exactly, water erosion. So as it turns out, Sedona has been underwater almost as much as it's been above the water over these, at least different 10 different times. Sedona has been pretty much immersed in water. And so it was apparently during those periods that these temples suffered more and more and more water damage until they took the shape and form that they are today. So unless you have like this interdimensional sight that I have and have had on occasion and still do, you're not going to see them in a perfection, and you're just going to keep walking by and say, well, you know, that's just a rock that looks a little bit like a temple.
But do the local Hopi natives do ceremony around those red rocks of Boynton Canyon?
Well, the Hopis consider that place to be extremely, extremely sacred, and they actually have burial grounds. There was a burial ground. There's a burial ground right at the entrance, which unfortunately a resort sits on, which is not a very good thing, which Hopis were definitely not very happy with. But there's a lot of other burial grounds inside of Boynton Canyon because it is such a sacred place. Now, besides that, I happen to know that one of the great leaders of the Hopis, especially within the last 150 years, David Monongi, he used to come to Sedona a lot, especially in his last years, and stay with a person here in Sedona. And when he was here, he always wanted to go into Boynton Canyon. That's the only place he wanted to go. And he told this person that there were eight places that he liked to go. These are eight very, very sacred places that my feeling is that they dated back to Lemuria times, the time of the Kachinas. One of the places was apparently a very big cave that had a huge crystal in it. And the medicine people of Hopi used to go there, and they would take their sacred objects and also their crystals and lay them on this huge crystal to be charged up with sacred energy. Now, for whatever reason, the government had come in and taken over that crystal. So they don't return to that cave anymore. But for a long time, they did. They did. Mm-hmm. Now, the tribe that actually comes back here the most often that I know of, and every year they come here and do a major ceremony, is the Yavapai. The Yavapai are the inner earth people. They started under the ground in the inner earth, and at one point their civilization was flooded, a huge flood. It was the same time as there was a flood on the top of the surface of the earth. It flooded their kingdom under the earth. And so at that point they said, okay, we're doomed unless we can save some of our race. So they put this girl in a canoe, a Yavapai, a young girl, and she floated up with the waters. As the waters filled up the underworld, she floated right through a big hole to the top of the Earth. She floated up through what is today known as Montezuma Well. It's a big sinkhole. And then so since the top of the Earth was also flooded, she kept going. And she floated all the way right into Boyne Canyon. And she floated right into a cave there. And then from that point on, she started the Yavapai race on the surface of the planet. She was drawn to go to a mountain close by here. When she climbed to the top of that, where she was inseminated by the sun, and she went back into Boyne Canyon and gave birth to a girl and a daughter. And then later on, her daughter went through the same process and gave birth to a son. And you know, it's these three that became kind of the matriarch of the Yavapai race. So this is what's commemorated by the Yavapai every year. They come here right next to that cave and do a major ceremony. And I have heard from some people that the Yavapai have actually even referred to Boyne Canyon as the temple of the canyon of the temples. So I think that they do have known what is really here.
Interesting. When we talk about potential alien or UFO bases, we always think of Teotihuacan, Baalbek, Lebanon, and places in South America, and having specific areas where these ships could lift off and do you know, get off the ground pretty quick. Where is it in Boynton Canyon that you have discovered where they could have done liftoff and then landings and things like that? Is there a certain area that looks like it has specific types of grading on the ground? Or is there megaliths of any dimension that look like suspiciously like they could have been platforms or any kind?
Well, the first time that I went in there and I saw those temples, one of the shapes that I saw was, it looked like a kind of a small wide base pyramid that was silver, made out of kind of like a silvery metal, and all four sides of it was this were these big golden discs, and I thought at the time it was a temple, and then I kind of went into the into the canyon, rummaged around, and then came back to where I could see this thing again, and it was gone, and so today I'm quite sure that that was itself a spaceship. And it actually it looked a lot like the spaceships that the Hopis described in their legends that I read later on. So it was a small ship, and it just was able to just land right there in a flat area. I mean, there have been a number of UFO sightings around Boyne Canyon, and apparently some of the UFOs have been able to just land right smack onto the bottom floor of the canyon, no problem. Some have been able to land much higher up. You know, if you follow the sides of the canyon to the very top, there'll be there's a lot of shelves up there that are totally flat. It'll be very, very easy for an extraterrestrial craft to land there as well. So it seems like there are many possibilities of places where they could or have landed.
Okay. Now, the Hopi actually describe these ships. Is that what you're saying? In their
they do.
Legacies?
They you know, they call in some cases they call them you know, that they were silver, like the one I saw. In some, they call them flying shields, big flying shields. Their description of them is very much like well, descriptions you read about today, you know, that they arrived and, you know, in kind of a blaze of a fire, and they left in a great blaze of fire. The descriptions sound very much like the descriptions of UFOs that throughout time have come and gone, and mm-hmm. or the UFOs and extraterrestrial crafts they associate with Atlantis, and more than any other time period, they associate them with the third world, which is the time period of Atlantis, mm-hmm. and so their description of these craft is very, very, very Atlantean. It's kind of like what you expect the crafts to look like that landed in Atlantis.
Okay. But that, I mean, Atlantis was, you know, 12,000 years ago plus. So are we talking about legends of craft in the legacy of the Hopi, or are we talking more present-day visitations from... the hope from these aliens?
We're talking about both.
Both, okay.
These Kachinas, many believe that these Kachinas stuck around. They were in physical body down to the time of the European invasion, right? If you can believe it, that they were actually physical until that time. But then they became invisible in order to survive, basically. And, of course, you know, they had good reason to be worried about what the Europeans would do to them, mm-hmm. or try to do to them, out of fear or not understanding them, and so they became invisible. A lot of the Kachinas are still here; they're just invisible. Mm-hmm. And half the year they live on the top of San Francisco Peaks in Flagstaff, and the other half of the year they live in the Hopi Reservation, but they're invisible spirits. When they come alive is during the dances. During the dances, a Hopi will wear the mask of a Kachina and then fully embody a spirit, mm-hmm. and then continue that way throughout the entire dance. He becomes one with that Kachina. He's given over his body to the Kachina spirit. So the Kachinas are still here, and as I said, they were physical right down to the time of the European invasion. So they would have been coming and going on in their craft right up until that time.
Right, but the Hopi have a number of Kachinas. They have star people Kachinas. They have animal spirit Kachinas. They have energetics that are Kachinas, like the wind and the fire and the earth and so on. Do they have Palakoepi, a Kachina that's designed from a planet? I mean, where does that race come from? What is there a planetary body it comes from?
Well, they don't have a Palakoepi Kachina per se, but they do have a Masao Kachina, and it does appear as though Masao, their patron deity, was from the Pleiades. And one reason that I have been able to deduce that is because I've gone all around the world and I've studied other cultures, and they all have a lord of the world, a king of the world, and which is their version of Masao. If you study the legends and the stories of these different kings of the world, they're almost identical in many cases to the story of Masao. And time after time, you find out that these other kings of the world came directly from the Pleiades. And oftentimes, they came by way of the planet Venus. Sanat Kumara, for example, he's popular in the metaphysical circles these days. He was one of those that is said that came from the Pleiades via Venus. In fact, one of his names is Kartikeya, which comes from Kritika, which means Pleiades. Kartikeya means son of the Pleiades. And Sanat Kumara came from the Pleiades and then stopped on Venus and then came here. Well, on Hopi Reservation, there's actually a couple of petroglyphs of spacecraft. And in both cases, they're supposed to represent Venus. And they represent the aliens, the ETs that came from Venus in ancient times to teach the Hopis, and they also represent those same star people are going to come again at the end times, like now. And one of those One of those petroglyphs was actually carved out by Masao, and could very well, probably was, a representation of his own craft, because he, in the legends, he flew around in his own little spacecraft, you know? Mm. And this is one way that he was able to monitor the migrations of the Hopis throughout the Western Hemisphere. He just flew around, and he could see exactly where they were and what they were up to.
You have to wonder if some of these legends that the Hopi have, as well as other Native American people, are handed down from star people. As an example, in your book, you have a whole chapter on the grid system for Sedona, and it's the Native Americans that I've talked to, and it's in their tradition too. They believe the Earth is a living being, and it has multiple chakra systems, but each city has their own. What, can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered regarding Sedona's grid and some of the high points that are unique to the not only Boynton Canyon but some of the other surrounding areas?
Yeah, sure. Well, at one point, as I've been going into Boynton Canyon, this is about 5 or 6 years ago, I was directed to a part of the canyon where I basically discovered this core. And it's kind of all these temples arranged in a horseshoe pattern. And in the center was like this mound that appeared to be like a throne. And so I'm thinking, well, this looks like the court of a king. Well, at one point I was able to see those temples in their perfection, and lo and behold, it really is like a court of a king. And one thing that I noticed is that I could see energy coming from above that would travel down these like huge crystalline rocks that surround the core, and it would bring energy into the core, and then that energy would travel right into that mound. And so it appears as though the mound or the throne was the focus of this energy. And I'm thinking at the time, well, it seems to be the focus of the energy in Boynton Canyon, and it could very well be the focus of the energy for the whole Sedona Vortex. Because I wasn't the first to come across upon that. And actually, there were others who have come along and said, well, Boynton Canyon is the center of the Sedona Vortex, and it extends out in 25 miles in all directions. And so as I'm looking at this mound and watching the energy enter it, I look to my right, and in a direct line from the core, I could see there was another of these four major vortexes. This one is called Bell Rock. And so there was a direct line that connected Boynton Canyon with Bell Rock. So I said, well, okay, well, this is significant, I need to follow up on this. So I went home and I got a map of Boynton, of all Sedona, and it had all the red rock formations represented in the map. And so I could see on the map this perfect line between Boynton Canyon and the Bell Rock, which now I believe to be the spine of Sedona. And I believe that Boynton Canyon is the root chakra. Just like the root chakra holds the kundalini in a human being, the court, and especially this throne mound, holds the kundalini of Sedona. So this energy, so this kundalini moves along the spine of Sedona to Bell Rock. And Bell Rock is an upflow vortex. See, Boynton is both an inflow and an outflow vortex, so it can take energy in and it can radiate out energy. So Boynton takes in the energy as an inflow vortex, moves it down the spine to Bell Rock, which is an upflow vortex, and then that energy rises up, up this gigantic bell-like figure, which today I call Crown Rock because it's the crown chakra. It rises up this great red rock formation to the top, and then the energy gets blasted throughout this whole entire area. And so then I was able to plot all the other chakras along this spine. And then what I did was that I simply tied in all the other red rock formations and Sedona into the spine, just like to create a grid. Just like everything in our body ties into our spine, I did the same for Sedona. And what I came up with was the grid of Sedona. One thing that you find, for example, is you have a 5- and 6-pointed star. Right? What's interesting is you have a 6-pointed star that one of the points of it is directly connected to the court of the king. And the 5-pointed star is connected to the 6-pointed star. Now, my belief today is that the most ancient of all religious traditions on the planet was the tradition of the goddess. You know, the goddess gave birth to her son every year, who's the lord of nature, the green man, who manifested as all vegetation. He lived and then he died in the fall with the death of all vegetation. And in this goddess tradition, the son becomes the lord of the world, the king of the world, to govern it for his mother, right? And so thus you have his symbol, the 6-pointed star. You can find around the world that is his symbol connected to his court. And supporting him in his reign is this 5-pointed star of his mother. And you can find the same kind of phenomenon in other parts of Sedona. I had a roommate back in the late 80s. Nicholas Mann was his name, a Brit. And he went out one day and he climbed to the top of a hill. And he looked out, and at one part of Sedona, he saw a perfect 5-pointed star. And each point was marked by an incredible red rock formation. Then he looked to the other side of Sedona, and he found a perfect 6-pointed star. And each of the points was there again, marked by a special red rock formation. And it was almost like it was strategically made, that these red rock formations were strategically placed in order to create this 5- and 6-pointed star. And these 5- and 6-pointed stars are connected together, and he measured the diameter of both of them. And both of the diameters of both the 5- and 6-pointed stars is a perfect ratio of the circumference of the Earth. Perfect ratio. So it definitely looks like they were strategically placed there in order to create this 5- and 6-pointed star, to generate this frequency that's associated with these sacred geometrical formations. So this is basically what I found in Sedona. I also did the grid of the whole state of Arizona. What I found when I did that is that there's a huge pyramidal structure. The grid creates a huge pyramid with the capstone of it being Sedona. And right in the center of this pyramid, the base of it, is Phoenix, of course, the firebird. And, of course, pyramid means fire in the middle. Right? And there it is.
That's really interesting. In your book, you actually show three photographs of craft, of spaceships or craft, and you designate them. I think one of them is a Venusian ship from Venus. One's a Pleiadian ship, and then there's a yellow starship. How did you get those photos, and how were they taken? Because they're almost pure light. It's fascinating.
Right. Well, one of them, well, actually a couple of them, two or three of them, were taken by a woman named Shekinah Rose. And she's been in Sedona, I don't know, 10, 15 years, but as soon as she got here, she started having experiences and encounters with Pleiadians. Most of her encounters have been in one of the four major vortexes in Cathedral Rock. And so most of the photos I have of her in the book were taken from there. And this is interesting because she also was able to perceive of this Venusian Pleiadian connection. So she's got some photos of her moving into this ball of light. She just completely disappears in this ball of light, and within that light, she's able to make direct contact with the Pleiadians. And then there another photo has this gigantic pink starship, which is also a portal. It's a Venusian portal that apparently can take you right to Venus. I mean, it's like a huge pink, like amoeba. You can, when you look at this thing, it's like totally alive. It's really amazing. Mm-hmm. She was able to take that photo herself, obviously. I don't know if she had somebody else take the others for her when she moved in the ball light or not. I think she might have had her photo apparatus maybe on a timer. And then you, these other starship was taken by a woman named Devara Thunderbee. Also, when she was around the Cathedral Rock vortex, and this starship is coming right out of the rock. And in fact, I have done a number of interviews with old time Sidonians, and they're in the back of the book. And invariably, they have had similar experiences where they have seen starships move, fly right into the rocks and right out of the rocks. It's like they move. It's like they're etheric crafts that can move right into the rocks and where perhaps there's a base or something inside the rocks, and then they move right out of the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically what you have here in the book.
Yeah. Is there a discernible geomagnetic energy coming out from any of those ruins? Have you tested
them? Oh, yeah. There's a ton of energy here. I mean, it's got one of the strongest electromagnetic fields in all the United States, or perhaps the whole world, actually. It actually has been measured, for sure. I mean, you have a seam of electromagnetic energy that actually starts up in Flagstaff. And in ancient times, it was totally covered with volcanoes. And of course, the volcanoes then connected to the source of Earth's electromagnetic field in the center of the Earth, and there was a seam that connected those volcanoes to Sedona. It comes right down through Oak Creek Canyon, and so there's electromagnetic current that comes down from Flagstaff to Sedona, and then when it gets here, because of the red rock being high in iron ore, all these red rock formations become electromagnetically charged, very, you know, very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So besides that, there was also the National Geological Survey that came here to measure the force, the powers that we have here, and the electromagnetic field and so forth. And they were able to measure very high energy, and one thing they attributed to is there is a huge layer of crystal right underneath the sandstone here, a huge layer of crystal, and a lot of people that were part of that geological survey they attributed this high energy, this very powerful energy to that crystal layer. Well, what's interesting is that leading up to that time of the geological survey, you had all kinds of psychics that were receiving information that underneath Sedona is a crystal city, right? But I couldn't prove it.
Yeah.
So a geological survey comes along and proves it, basically. You know?
That's fascinating. I asked that because a lot of early Americans people that were became Native Americans understood a lot of the natural ley lines, but also geomagnetic fields that would bubble up, and a lot of mounds were built over them, and a lot of Native pyramids in the Central America were built over these geomagnetic fields, and to hear about starships coming up out of the ground would make me think that they understand the natural flow of geomagnetic energy from the Earth.
Right. Well, actually, some of the people that I interviewed that had witnessed that, they received information at the time intuitively that these craft had actually gone inside the rocks in order to refuel on the electromagnetic energy that was in the rocks.
That's amazing. I think that would probably go for the chakra system would be something that would be handed down from maybe a higher intelligence too. So What did you gain from, I mean, you write a lot in your book about chakras, about the ETs, about this ruined city. What do we know today? What is the continued tradition with the natives today, the Hopi today, in that Boynton Canyon area? Are there sacred wisdom schools associated with that area?
Well, they believe we're in the time of purification leading up to the fifth world. And at that time, that Sedona will be a very, very important sacred site during this next cycle of the fifth world. They believe that many of the star people are going to be returning from Venus, the Pleiades, and a lot of them will be coming here. This whole process of their return started like in the 70s, where they started having all kinds of UFO sightings on Hopi Reservation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they invited some reporters to come. And on demand, the UFOs showed up, and you know, they took photos of them and wrote about them. So that was really the very beginning of it. So they're expecting, I mean, virtually thousands of these star people to be returning. Now, what's interesting is that their prophecy, their understanding of the return of the star people is exactly the same as people on the other side of the world call Yazidis. And Yazidis are the people that are getting decimated by the Muslim terrorist group known as ISIS. Hmm. Now, the Yazidis have a very similar belief system that this being that they know as the king of the world, which they call the peacock angel, which as it turns out is really identical to Masao, that the peacock angel is going to be returning with, like, I mean, they even have a number, 11,000 star people on his entourage they're coming back. In order to teach us what we need to know now, in order to move to the next level. Hmm. And one thing that I was able to learn around this court that I discovered in Morton Canyon is it is definitely a court, the court of Masao. Masao was one of the inhabitants of Palakwapi. In fact, he was one of the main teachers of the Hopi. But at one point, when I saw all those temples, I saw them covered with peacock symbology, and I knew at that time that the peacock angel and Masao were one and the same. And in fact, in order to get confirmation on that, I brought the Hopis and the Yazidis together back in December 21st, 2012, put them in the same room, and so they could discuss this. And yeah, lo and behold, yeah, you know what you believe about Masao, same as we believe in peacock angel, and vice versa.
Hmm.
It was within last couple of years, I've actually brought Yazidis to the court of the Peacock Angel so they could see it for themselves, you know, here in Sedona. And they recognize it. They recognize it as the court of their king. And because of that, a lot of Yazidis that are in refugee camps in northern Iraq right now, they want to settle in Arizona, and especially they'd love to be able to settle here in Sedona so they can be near the court of their king.
Hmm. That is amazing. How did you get a connection with the Yazidis? Did you recognize their symbology or something and kind of compare it to Hopi symbology?
It was about 15 years ago or so. I was up in the Andes. I'd been studying with a shaman down there in a form of shamanism known as Wachuma shamanism, where you make a cactus into a liquid. You drink the liquid and expand your consciousness. And this is what these shamans had been doing for virtually thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So I apprenticed with one of them for about 3 years. And one time we were high up in the Andes, about 13,000 feet, and we drank some of the Wachuma, and immediately I was transported into another realm.
Hmm.
And I was surrounded by thousands, millions of eyes. It was like all the forms of nature kind of opened its eyes at the same time. Now, when I looked at these eyes, at first they looked human, but then I realized, well, they're not quite human. There's something a little bit different about them. And then I realized, okay, well, these are the eyes, quote-unquote, you find on a peacock feather. And then, lo and behold, they were on peacock feathers, and then I would trace those peacock feathers to the bodies of actual peacocks, And then I realized that, you know, there was hundreds and thousands of these peacocks all around me. And everything, you know, everything was peacock. And even the mountains turned into these gigantic peacocks. So I'm like, what the heck is this? I'd never been here before. And I had no clue where I was. I just knew I was in the land of the peacock, right? And so when I get done with that experience, I came back home to the States, and I started looking around the Internet. It's like, can anyone tell me, can any civilization, any tradition of the past, can they tell me what I experienced? Mm-hmm. I couldn't find anything until I came across these Eddies. And these Eddies have a legend of the peacock angel, that when the peacock angel first arrived on Earth, it came at a time when there was no life, no vegetation on the planet, no real life on the planet. It came down in this form of this gigantic peacock and landed in a place called Lalish, the most sacred place of the Yazidis today in northern Iraq. And when it landed, then it spread its peacock plumes all around the planet. And then those peacock plumes crystallized to become all the forms of nature. So this was the original green man.
Hmm.
But those etheric peacock feathers still exist on another dimension. And this is what I was able to experience, and I've experienced many times since. And so, like, for example, when I go to the Court of the King today in Boyne Canyon, immediately I can see, you know, hundreds of thousands of peacocks. All the vegetation, the bushes, everything turns into these peacocks, right? Which is really quite fascinating, because when you get done with that experience and you lower your consciousness and you're seeing the vegetation as we normally do, you say to yourself, how come I didn't see that? How come I can't see that this vegetation, that its etheric imprint is actually a peacock? Because, I mean, you really only have to tweak your vision. You only have to tweak your perception a little bit in order for this physical vegetation to turn into peacock. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true, you know, and I've had that experience many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how I originally came across these Eddies. After that, I contacted the community up in Lincoln, Nebraska. That's the biggest community here in the States. There's about 600 Eddies there. And then I went up there a couple of times and studied with one of their fakirs, one of their holy men that know all the legends of the peacock angel. And I've also been in touch with some, you know, fakirs in Iraq, although I haven't been over there. And they taught me all about the peacock angel.
Hmm.
And since that time, I've been working as hard as I can to assist the Yazidis. I think one reason that I was shown the peacock angel, is so that I could help the people today. It was necessary for at least one person on the planet to understand the truth behind what the peacock angel is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Muslims, for example, they're out to destroy the Yazidis, and one reason is because they associate the peacock angel with Satan or Lucifer, which he's not at all. But that's how they have come to understand him, you see. And so through my experience, I see him in a totally different way. And because of that, I can assist the Yazidis. I can help to inform the entire world of what the peacock angel really is all about.
Hmm.
You know, so the people will come to the aid of the Yazidis. I've done that with the Hindus, for example. Thousands and thousands of Hindus are now helping the Yazidis because I was able to prove to them that the peacock angel is the same as their being Sanat Kumara. He's the king of the world in their tradition. He's this young boy that rides on a peacock. And I've been able to convince them that they are exactly the same deity. And so the Hindus are embracing these Eddies today like they're their own family. In fact, they believe that in very ancient times, these Eddies were, Eddies and Hindus were one people. And so this is what I've been able to do in order to help and save these Eddies. And I think this is definitely one reason that I was shown this peacock angel and have had to learn all about him and what he's all about.
Interesting. In the few minutes we have left, Mark, this book, Sedona, City of the Star People, what is the takeaway you want people to have on this? I mean, you get it into a lot of different material. In fact, you even have some Knights of Templar research that you post in there. But that's too much for now. I was curious about that because we've had a number of people on the show, including Scott Walter, who's the host of American Unearthed, who's big on a finding evidence of Templars here in the United States. But what's the takeaway? What do you want the reader to really gain from this book?
Well, I want him to, first of all, to perceive Sedona as the city of the Star People, because there are faces in the Red Rock, there are images of animals, there's images of what looks like temples, and if you open your consciousness with the belief that you are in the city of the Star People, you'll start to see these temples and these sculptures in their perfection, and there'll be no question in your mind, you know, that these were created by other than natural, you know, rock formation. Mm-hmm. Also, I want people to get an idea that there is a court of a king, that this king of the world that exists, because I think one thing is happening now is that this most ancient tradition of the goddess and her son is going to be revived. And people are going to get to know, again, this king of the world, because he's always existed. He's always existed on another dimension. And now, as we collectively, as a race, open up more psychically, we are going to be able to see him. He exists in this dimension that I call the Garden of Eden. And we left the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden didn't leave us. It's always been there. It's the next dimension up. And so many of us are going to start to see that dimension and have direct experiences of this king of the world. So I want to help to prepare people for that experience. And I also want to get the message across about who the Uzedis are, how important they are to this world, and how important it is to understand these people, because they call themselves the first people. They were directly created by this peacock angel to be his people. And so they hold the key of so much of what has happened to humanity since the very beginning. They are amazing people. I have studied the mystery traditions all over the world, and what I find is at the root of all of them are the mysteries of the peacock angel. They were the very first. Hmm. So I want people to take note of that this, the Zetis and their tradition, extremely, extremely ancient and extremely, extremely important for humanity to understand its origins, why we're here, and where we're going.
Fascinating. Okay, so Sedona, City of the Star People, will be out first week of November. But for now, people can get a hold of you.
They can order a copy through the Templar website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. If you go to the web store on that page, you'll take you right to a page where you can order that book. So that's gnostictemplar.org. And I'd also like people to, if they can, take a look at sacredsitesjourneys.com. It's on that website that you find the tours, the sacred tours that my wife and I lead around the world, as well as around Sedona, where I show people the landmarks associated with Polycroft, including the Court of the King.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, well, again, the book, my guest today has been Mark Pinkham, and the book is Sedona, City of the Star People. Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting hour, and look forward to hearing more about your discoveries and your research, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Cliff. It's been a lot of fun.